Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Joe Epstein. I'm a past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for today's program. And now it is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Nina Teicholz, former NPR journalist and author of the new book, The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in Your Healthy Diet. Years ago, while a reporter for a San Francisco radio station, KQED, Nina Teicholz would rely on recipes she could find in her kitchen from Green's Restaurant, a local vegan eatery. And today, she is basking in a sea of culinary controversy over the subject matter of her new book, The Big Fat Surprise. I used to be a vegetarian. I heard her say this yesterday while being interviewed on KQED's program Forum. And apparently, she still has a way to go to convince some of her family that it is okay to incorporate some saturated fat into your diet. And perhaps she may have her work cut out for her tonight to convince many of you in the audience as well. In this captivating and convincing narrative, based on a 10-year investigation, Nina shows how misinformation about saturated fats took hold in the scientific community as well as in the public imagination, and how recent findings overturned these beliefs. And despite some expected criticisms about her credentials to interpret scientific data, Nina does make a convincing argument backed up by hard facts and data. Is it possible that the long-heralded Mediterranean diet is not the healthiest choice for us? Is it possible that for years we have been replacing trans fats with something worse? And for many of us, in recent years, our dietary choices have changed dramatically as we've dodged saturated fats in our diet like a plague in favor of kale, seaweed, radicchio, and other bitter-tasting foods. Well, according to Nina, almost nothing we commonly believe today about fats generally, and saturated fats in particular, appears to be accurate. Nina Teicholz wrote on food and nutrition science for Gourmet and Men's Health magazine. She was a reporter for NPR for years, covering Washington, D.C. and Latin America, and she has also contributed on a variety of topics to the New York Times and Salong, among other publications. In addition, she has served as the Associate Director for the Center of Globalization and Sustainable Development at Columbia University. She studied biology at Yale and Stanford Universities, and she earned a master's degree from Oxford. Nina lives in New York with her husband Gregory, two children, and it's time now to give a very warm Commonwealth Club welcome to journalist and author Nina Teicholz.
Well, thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having me here, and it's a pleasure to be here. Well, for 50 years, we've felt guilty about eating red meat, creamy cheese, butter, whole-fat dairy, and fried eggs. We've been avoiding these foods because they contain saturated fat, and saturated fats are supposed to be the number one dietary culprit in causing heart disease. And they're also, these foods are naturally high in fat, and we also believe that fat overall makes you fat, so we avoid them for that reason, too. Well, my plan tonight, through an analysis of the science and the history, is to try to take some of the guilt out of those guilty pleasures. So I'm going to tell you how we came to believe that these fats are bad for you, how and why scientists got it wrong, and what was the role of the food industry, what have been the unintended consequences of getting this wrong, and what the science says now about these fats. And I'll also tell you how you can advise your children to defend bacon to their progressive vegetarian hippie day camp counselors, as has been my particular challenge this week. So let's start. Where do our ideas about fat come from? It really goes back to the 1950s, when the nation was in a panic over the rising tide of heart disease, which had come from seemingly out of nowhere in the early 1900s to become the nation's number one killer. President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack in 1955 and was out of the Oval Office for 10 days. So there was a tremendous sense of urgency about the need to find an explanation about what might be causing heart disease. And there were a number of different ideas. Some were that it was excessive stress, vitamin deficiency, and automobile exhaust. However, the winning theory was proposed by one scientist, whose name is Ansel Keys, a pathologist at the University of Minnesota. He came up with the idea that it was saturated fats that cause heart disease. They would raise your total cholesterol, they would therefore clog your arteries and cause a heart attack. And this was called the diet heart hypothesis. And Ansel Keys was an outsized man. He was very charismatic. He was a bit of a bulldog. He was called arrogant, even by his friends. And he managed to implant his idea into the American Heart Association. The American Heart Association, their nutritional advice has long been considered the gold standard for fighting heart disease. And the nutrition committee had been openly skeptical of Ansel Keys' ideas. But then he managed to get himself appointed to the committee, and just a year later, he was able to swivel the committee around to follow his own views. So that in 1961, the American Heart Association issued the country's very first anti-saturated fat advice to middle-aged men, telling them to cut back on meat, cheese, and full-fat dairy as their best strategy to avoid heart disease. In that same year, 1961, Ansel Keys was also on the cover of Time magazine. He was Mr. Cholesterol, and even though he himself was described as eating red meat several times a week, because, as he said, nobody wants to live on mush, he told Americans that they should cut their fat intake from their current level of about 40% of calories to down to 15% or less. And he's quoted as saying, "People should know the facts, and then if they want to eat themselves to death, let them." So he really became the most influential scientist of his day, and arguably of, you know, of the last 100 years. But what at the time was the evidence that was supporting this hypothesis? In 1961, it really boiled down to one study that coincidentally had been done by Ansel Keys. And it really was the big bang of all nutrition studies, because it was a time when the whole field was in a state, it was in its infancy, and very little science had been done. And he did this really heroically pioneering effort called the Seven Country Study. He studied almost 13,000 men in seven countries, in Europe, the US, and Japan. And he found what he had hoped to find, which was a correlation between low consumption of saturated fat and your risk for having a heart attack. But his study has since been analyzed by a number of critics, and it's the methodological problems that have been found are really quite significant, calling into question the whole study itself. For one, he deliberately chose countries that he knew would support his hypothesis. So he chose countries like Italy and Greece, where he knew that they had a low consumption of saturated fat and low rates of heart disease, while avoiding France, Germany, Switzerland, where they ate a lot more saturated fat, but also had low rates of heart disease. And then there's the problem of that he had tremendous problems with his dietary data and his survey data. He ended up throwing out all of his dietary surveys and ending up with a sample of only 500 men, 500 out of nearly 13,000. And his STAR data subjects, who ate only 8% of all their calories as saturated fat and had low rates of heart disease, were on the island of Crete. He and his researchers sort of fell in love with the island of Crete, but they only got reliable dietary data from 33 or 34 men there, and none of those sample sizes were statistically significant. And even with all of those problems aside, it was what's called an epidemiological study, which shows association and not causation. That's a really important theme that runs throughout the history of nutrition science, which is that it's very hard to do nutrition science, especially the kind of clinical trials that are really the firm, hard evidence that can be used to establish causation. It's hard to feed people, it's expensive, it's hard to get people to change their diets over any period of time. And in the absence of that kind of harder data, it's this soft epidemiological data, this associational data that has been made to suffice. And that really started with Ansel Keys and his seven-country study. But of course, it wasn't just one man and one study. There are many scientists, obviously expert scientists. And so how did this idea get propelled along? And the short answer is that it really became institutionalized and hardened into dogma before those clinical trials could be conducted. So opinions were formed, and the policy was set before the science could actually be done. And it wasn't just the American Heart Association, but also the National Institute of Health that embraced the idea that saturated fats were the cause of heart disease. And these organizations worked really in close concert with each other. The same group of elite academic experts served at both places like an interlocking directorate. The same small group came to control the allocation of research grants, and they'd carry out the studies that were funded by those grants, and they would review each other's studies, and they sat on the editorial boards of the research journals. I mean, this is still true today. And everyone really got on board with this cholesterol bandwagon, as it was called by the editors of the Journal of the American Medical Association, who said, quote, "An almost embarrassingly high number of researchers boarded this cholesterol bandwagon. It was an overly narrow, fervent embrace of cholesterol to the exclusion of all other biochemical processes that might cause heart disease." And that was in 1967. And it was the same select group of experts who were influential in the late 1970s in advising the U.S. Senate when they took up the subject. Senator George McGovern led a committee, and the outcome of that committee's work was the conclusion that a low-fat diet, also restricted in meat and dairy products, should be recommended not just for middle-aged men, but for all Americans over the age of 2. And that led to the USDA issuing the very first dietary guidelines in 1980, and the dietary guidelines are the basis of the food pyramid that you probably all know. So now you have all the giant wheels of the massive federal government working behind this one hypothesis, that saturated fat and cholesterol cause heart disease, and all of the accompanying agencies got in line behind it because that was the will of the government, the FDA, the Surgeon General, the Health and Human Services, all working to propel this advice forward. And where were the critics? Because, of course, there were plenty of critics along the way. There were scientists really at the top of their fields. And if there's one Cassandra in this story, one particular researcher whose cautionary words were lost in the wind, that was Pete Ahrens, one of the finest lipid scientists of his day at Rockefeller University, who was constantly urging restraint. He was issuing warnings about the weak state of the evidence and that the rigorous clinical trials were still needed. But just to give you an idea of how Ancel Keys and his colleagues dealt with these critics in what I call the blood sport of nutrition science, which if Ancel Keys and his colleagues did not pioneer, they certainly perfected it. Here's how Keys dispatched one of his critics, a prominent researcher at Texas A&M University named Theodore Reiser. And this is what Keys says in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the premier publication of the nutrition world. He said, "Reiser reminds one of the distorting mirrors in a hall of jokes at a county fair. Reiser pompously states he completely ignores. Obviously, Reiser has no comprehension," which is really not what you expect in scientific debate. Literally name-calling and relentless sneering and condescension towards anyone who disagreed with them. But Keyes was, and his colleagues were, successful. And Pete Ahrens knew that his career would suffer as a result for being an outspoken critic. I wasn't able to speak to him directly, but I did interview George Mann, who is from Vanderbilt University and another vehement critic of Keyes. And he was fairly successful and a member of the nutrition elite in the 1970s. But he told me that one day he was at NIH and a secretary took him out into the hallway and said, "Your outspoken criticism of Keyes is going to cost you your research grant if you don't stop it." And he indeed lost his grant. So in this environment where institutions, research dollars, and other investments were all lining up behind one idea, it was very hard to do good science or to be a good scientist. You know, scientists are trained to try to confront their biases and to constantly question and challenge their beliefs. So the great philosopher of science, Karl Popper, described it as, "The method of science is the method of bold conjectures and ingenious and severe attempts to refute them." But this was an environment where the exact opposite was going on. And Keyes used to say, he would say just the opposite of that. He would say, "I'm who can prove me wrong? I am right until proven wrong." So another way of saying that is that a bias set in amongst experts, and they selected data points in their favor, and then they ignored those that were not in their favor. It's called selection bias, and it is fairly stunning to see this at work over the decades of nutrition science since the 1960s. I'm just going to give you a few examples because they're so astonishing. Observations that directly contradicted the diet heart hypothesis. So there was the Harvard-trained anthropologist, a man named Stefansson, who went and lived with the Inuit in the Arctic, found that they ate mostly caribou and seal. Altogether, he estimated about 70% of their diet was fat. He said, "The fat deposits behind the caribou eye and along the jaw were the most prized, followed by the rest of the head, the heart, the kidney, and the shoulder. The leaner parts, including the tenderloin, were fed to the dogs." Which I just love, because of course that's the opposite of what we do today. And he was well known in his day, and Keyes knew of him, as did others. And then there was George Mann, whom I mentioned, from the University of Vanderbilt. He went to work in Kenya and studied the Maasai warriors, who he found ate nothing but meat and milk and blood, an estimated 60% of fat. He did electrocardiograms on 400 of them and found no evidence of heart attacks. He also found that their cholesterol level was exceedingly low. He tried to rule out the possibility that it might be some kind of genetic exception, so he followed some of the warriors who had moved to Nairobi and found that when their diet changed, their cholesterol levels went up, more in line with the locals, which seemed to rule out the genetic exception idea. And all of this he published in mainstream nutrition journals that were read by Keyes and his colleagues. Then there was a scientist named Malhotra who analyzed the records of 1 million employees of the railroad in India in the mid-1960s and found that the rate of heart disease among railroad sweepers in Madras in southern India were 7 times higher than for Punjabi railroad sweepers in the north, even though they were eating 8 to 19 times more fat in the north, mostly from dairy products. And the southerners ate very little fat, and what they did eat was unsaturated groundnut oil. Nevertheless, they died on average 12 years earlier than their counterparts in the north. And that was published in a very prominent journal, and that was also ignored. Which isn't to say that a high-fat diet is a better diet. It just says it's impossible to hypothesize that your low-fat diet is healthy if you take these observations into consideration. And just one other example of selection bias, where science exercised that kind of bias against their very own studies. So probably the single most astounding example of this was the Minnesota Coronary Survey, which was an NIH-funded study in 6 Minnesota state mental hospitals and 1 nursing home starting in 1968 with 9,000 men and women, the biggest ever test of the diet-heart hypothesis. Some of those people were eating an 18% saturated fat diet, and others ate half that amount. Their diet was mostly margarine and vegetable oil-based. Went on for 4.5 years, and at the end, there was no difference found in cardiovascular death or overall mortality rates. And even Ivan France, who was a diet heart stalwart, sat on those results. He didn't publish them for 16 years. And when he finally did, he submitted them to an obscure journal that was not commonly read by people in his field. And when he was much later asked why, he said, "We were just disappointed in the way it came out." So, and in the trials that scientists did cite, there are really 4 major clinical trials that are supposed to be the bedrock proof of the diet-heart hypothesis. And it showed that vegetable oils did successfully lower total cholesterol, and that in some of them there was actually a reduction in cardiac events, but there were significantly higher rates of death from other things, including cancer and higher rates of gallstone. All of that was so worrying that the National Institute of Health in the early 1980s had a series of expert panels to try to figure out what that was about, and they couldn't. But overall mortality in the 2 groups was the same. So these trials could not demonstrate that you could lengthen your life by cutting back on saturated fats. But at a certain point, there was just no turning back. There are literally billions of dollars in research funds became invested in this hypothesis. Careers were founded upon it, institutions depended upon it, and too much institutional energy and research money had already been spent trying to prove this hypothesis. So by the mid-1980s, the critics were basically silenced. And through a mixture of politics, bias, personal ambition, and bad science, a consensus had been sealed up. And what was the role of the food companies? I'm often asked, where was the meat, egg, and dairy producers? Why did they not stop this? Weren't they so powerful? And to which I answered, they were powerful. They are powerful, and they did try. But it turns out the big manufacturing companies are more powerful. Companies like who, since the 1940s, have known the importance of influencing nutrition science, General Foods, Quaker Oats, National Biscuit Company, Corn Products Refining Company. And just to give you one little example of that, Procter & Gamble, which makes Crisco oil, in 1948, they basically went to the American Heart Association, which at that point was just this little sleepy cardiology society, nothing like the giant powerhouse that it is now. And they were struggling for funds. Procter & Gamble said, we will make you the designee of a radio contest called the Walking Men Contest, and overnight, American Heart Association received millions of dollars and was transformed into the national powerhouse, opening chapters up all across the country, became a huge volunteer organization, and coincidentally was recommending that everybody eat vegetable oils instead of saturated fats. But I have to say that the mistakes that were made were really primarily ones of science. Because scientists are the gatekeepers on expert panels publishing public health advice. And these scientists, I think they really believe their recommendations. It's just that the initial science was weak, and they jumped the gun on it, and the science could never catch up. So in 1977, after Mark Hegstead, a Harvard nutrition professor, had successfully persuaded the U.S. Senate to recommend the low-fat diet for the entire nation. He said, it isn't a question of whether Americans should change their diets, but why not? Important benefits could be expected. And what are the risks? None can be identified. Well, now it's 50 years later, and we are definitely fatter and diabetic, and while we have made tremendous strides in treating heart disease, the underlying rates of heart disease have gone down very little. So what are the unintended consequences? Is there a link between this dietary advice and the kind of suffering, the load of disease that we're suffering from today? I think there are basically two unintended consequences. One is that we've increased vegetable oils, as we've been told. So before 1900, the only fats that American housewives cooked with were butter and lard. And we ate in 1900 pretty much 0% of our calories as vegetable oils. Now we eat 7 to 8% of all of our calories as vegetable oils. And these oils have just brought with them a number of unknown issues. So when they're hardened through a process called hydrogenation to make Crisco, which was introduced in 1911, and then margarine, both hugely successful products, when they're hydrogenated, one of the byproducts of that is trans fats, which we really started to understand the health effects of those relatively recently. Also, it seems that vegetable oils, which contain a lot of what's called omega-6 fatty acids, seem to compete and dull the effects of omega-3 fatty acids, which you've probably heard are, you know, healthy in fish oils. These two kinds of fatty acids seem to compete metabolically. And finally, it's been known since the 1940s that when these vegetable oils are heated, they produce toxic oxidation products. More than 100 of them have been found in a single piece of chicken, fried chicken, and vegetable oil alone. And these toxic products appear to produce huge inflammatory effects and possible gastric damage, amongst many other things. And our state of understanding or reckoning with this science is pretty much where we were with trans fats back in the 1970s. And one of the good qualities, unsung good qualities of saturated fats is they're solid at room temperature. They're stable. They do not oxidize when heated. It used to be that McDonald's fried their French fries in tallow. Now we have switched over to vegetable oils, about which we know so little. And that's one of the unintended consequences, I think, of getting rid of saturated fats. The other major unintended consequence is the increased amount of carbohydrates that we eat. So, you know, in retrospect, it seems obvious this would happen. If you take meat, cheese, and eggs off the plate, foods that have historically been at the heart of our meals, what fills the empty space? The answer is pasta, grains, potatoes, and these are all very high in carbohydrates, which is as the USDA instructed us to do. That giant bottom slab of the USDA food pyramid is all grains, breads, pasta. And the problem with carbohydrates is that they break down into glucose in the bloodstream. Glucose triggers the release of insulin, and insulin seems to be the king of all hormones for sucking away fat. In fact, in experiments on animals, they show it's almost impossible to get fat without insulin. And chronic exposure to insulin seems to be what leads to type 2 diabetes. And again, it's carbohydrates that are the main cause of insulin release in your bloodstream. So there's now a growing number of scientists who are starting to investigate carbohydrates, fructose versus glucose, what are their impacts on the body. And that's really an enormous seismic shift in nutrition thinking, which is just hard to overemphasize because really, you know, for decades we have focused exclusively on dietary fat as the main culprit, and now we're looking at carbohydrates. I just have to do a little hat tip to Gary Taubes there, who was a big part of that shift. And now many clinical trials have been done. We've spent more money testing the low-fat diet than any other diet in the history of nutrition. And that diet has been tested on tens of thousands of people. And it cannot be said to help in helping weight loss or fighting heart disease or diabetes. Or it seems any kind of cancer. There was a very small effect on ovarian cancer seen in one study, but that was counterbalanced by an increase in breast cancer, so it's really hard to know. So it seems like fat does not make you fat. That seems like just this tragic homonym. The fat we eat, we've always thought is the fat we get, same word, but there does not seem to be a connection. Still, that idea that fat doesn't make you fat, that overall we shouldn't be limiting fat, that seems to kind of have percolated into the expert community. But there's still a strong belief that saturated fat, the kind in meat, cheese, butter, dairy, eggs, causes heart disease and is bad for you. And now the American Heart Association's latest recommendation has ratcheted back recommended levels even further now to 5 or 6% of calories, which is really unseen in human history other than in periods of extreme post-war deprivation. It's far less than even those Cretan islanders ate. So, you know, I think the contribution that I try to make in my book is laying out in the sustained arguments about why saturated fats are not bad for health. And I really lay out the studies so that a reader can see for him or herself what they say. And I just want to say, you know, there's still this apparent linchpin of evidence that saturated fats cause your LDL cholesterol to go up. And I just want to mention a little bit about that, which is that's supposed to be the slam dunk piece of evidence against saturated fats. And first, it's important to say that there is no evidence to show that LDL cholesterol, lowering your LDL cholesterol through diet prevents heart disease. There's some limited evidence for that statins, drugs, can have an effect, but not diet. And as our understanding of heart disease markers has evolved over the years, including the extremely important work of Dr. Ron Krauss here, who has shown that LDL cholesterol can be broken down into subfractions. There's light buoyant LDL versus small dense LDL, and saturated fat and fat increase, especially when compared to carbohydrates, increase the kind of LDL that is supposed to be good. In other words, and switching to a carbohydrate-based diet increases the kind of small dense LDL that is more closely associated with your heart attack risk. So, So I just wanted, it seems then the case against saturated fat is dismantled, and the evidence against it upon closer inspection does not hold up. What seems to sustain the case now appears to be our long-standing bias against it. And I just want to say a short word about, beyond the argument that saturated fat isn't bad for you, can you make the argument that saturated fat is actually good for you? Should we not just stay away from these foods as a measure of caution, or is there an argument for eating meat, butter, dairy, eggs, cheese? And I think there are. I think for one is that these foods are extremely nutritionally dense. So certain vitamins such as B6 and B12 are uniquely available in animal foods. Other vitamins, A, D, E, and K, can only be absorbed when they're accompanied by fat. So if you're drinking skim milk, you're not fully absorbing these vitamins. And without those vitamins, you're not absorbing the minerals. And animal foods are really the naturally occurring perfect package of vitamins and minerals together with the fat needed to absorb them. Plus protein. Red meat turns out to be far more nutrient dense than chicken. Red meat contains selenium, folate, iron, zinc, which are barely present in chicken. So these animal foods really deliver a powerful dose of healthy nutrition that is not so easily available and bioavailable in plant foods. Also, these foods are almost essential if you want to eat a diet higher in fat. One of the things that's happened over the past decade is there have been a lot of clinical trials comparing a high-fat, carbohydrate-restricted diet to the low-fat diet. And the high-fat diet really performs much better in terms of weight loss and diabetes and heart disease markers. And how do you get to a high-fat diet? Unless you're like Italian peasants drinking bowlfuls of olive oil, it's hard, though not impossible, to eat a high-fat diet without eating animal foods. Also, these foods are uniquely satiating, which is to say there's something about fat and protein we don't really quite understand, but that fills you up. So, and they have tried to make people, prisoners, overeat on meat, and they just cannot. They look at a stack of pork chops and just cannot eat anymore. Whereas experiments have found it's very easy to overeat on carbohydrates, on pasta, popcorn. Those foods are not as naturally satiating. So it could very well be that because we've so greatly reduced animal foods over the last 30 years, that we're all walking around in a state of being hungry, trying to fill up on carbs. And because we do eat more calories now than we did 40 years ago, why is that? Why did we all become gluttonous? Why are our grandparents have an easier time of not being gluttonous? And it's possible that we're just not eating enough fat and protein, and we're trying to fill ourselves up on carbohydrates. So one other argument in favor of saturated fats. Before the epidemics of heart disease, obesity, and diabetes, these fats were at the centerpieces of meals for thousands of years. From Athena laying down a fat goat in the chine of a great wild hog rich in lard for Odysseus, to Isaiah prophesizing in the Old Testament that the Lord would make unto all people a feast of fat things full of marrow, to Pip's theft of a pork pie in Great Expectations, it is very hard to find people eating salads in history, in the history of literature. And so nutrition science has really ignored this history at our peril. So it's time to welcome these nutritious and delicious foods, guilt-free, back into our lives. Thank you.
Our thanks to Nina Teicholz, a former NPR journalist and author of a new book, The Big Fat Surprise. I'm Dr. Ronald Krause. I'm senior scientist and director of atherosclerosis research at Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute and also on the faculty at UCSF and UC Berkeley. I'll be moderating today's audience question period. And as you can see from the pile on my desk here, we already have quite a few, and I'll apologize in advance. We're going to have trouble, I think, addressing all of the questions. So what I'll take the prerogative of doing, which is a great treat for me, since during the course of Nina's research for her book, she had the opportunity to ask me quite a few questions. Mm-hmm. And so now I will return the favor by asking her some questions. So the first question I've chosen here, I think, is one that, that you could perhaps give some thought to. How does a lack of conclusive correlation between a low-fat diet so people have printed very well, but everybody has a different definition of printing, I'm afraid. As an MD, my definition is illegible, and it's possible this was written by a physician. I can't be sure. So how does the lack of a conclusive correlation between a low-fat diet and health risks of heart disease in particular imply the converse? So studies of the Inuit and Maasai notwithstanding, there are also studies like the Levina study documenting the long-term health effects of veganism. So how can we use such a geographically and scientifically disparate data set to make such definitive conclusions? In particular, tossing aside lines of evidence being inadequate for a low-fat diet approach, how does that justify the opposite?
So I think that the starting point answering that question is that the low-fat diet was a hypothesis. So that is not our default diet. When you have a hypothesis, you have an obligation to provide evidence for that hypothesis. If your evidence, despite billions of dollars of effort, does not hold up, then you have to say, okay, that hypothesis is not a good hypothesis. We need an alternative hypothesis. If at the end of eating a low-fat diet, which we did successfully, we cut back our saturated fats by 11%, we've increased our carbohydrates by 25%, if you're fatter and sicker, and if all your clinical trials cannot support your hypothesis, you have to dispense with it and try something else. I'm not proposing any particular alternative hypothesis. There's a number of alternative hypotheses out there, and they also need to be tested and have evidence accumulate beneath them to support them or not. So I just think it's time to let go of this hypothesis.
Okay. All right, we'll come back to that point perhaps in a few minutes. Here's an interesting thought. Have there been any criticisms of your book that make you question yourself? i.e., have you learned things in the process of occasions such as this or other interactions that may have given you a slight different perspective? If so, what are those changes?
Yes, but I think that... I did not do a tremendous amount of research into looking at different kinds of carbohydrates, and I think there has been a tremendous amount of science done recently about refined carbohydrates, unrefined carbohydrates, fructose versus glucose. I treat that, I think, pretty superficially in my book. I think there are questions about how people respond to them differently. I am also curious about the apparent successes that people had, getting back to the other question, on a vegan diet. I think that is interesting to me, and I want to understand that more fully because it does seem to contradict much of what I found, but I don't understand that science fully yet.
Well, that's, I think, a great point because it actually addresses one of the other questions that I'll just touch on briefly. The New York Times has an article now from a cardiologist who's somebody who I know very well, actually, recommending a vegan diet, saying he's lowered his cholesterol levels significantly. Where is the disconnect? And you don't necessarily have to answer the question about the cholesterol, but just this general notion, which I think you started to touch on, is that really, have you learned anything that would dispute the potential benefits of a vegan diet, and is there potentially commonality with what you've learned with that approach?
Well, I think that what all successful diets have in common, the first thing that they say is to eliminate processed foods, particularly sugar, high fructose corn syrup, white flour. And I think that some of what we see on radically different kinds of diets is that common adjustment that people make. They feel better and their health looks better when they do that. But beyond that, I think that from what I can tell, the evidence base for a vegan diet seems still to be quite slender. Dean Ornish has done really one controlled clinical trial, well-controlled clinical trial, looking at his program on heart disease risk factor outcomes on 22 men, 19 of whom finished that study, and a study that was also confounded by the fact that he also prescribes dietary supplements and stress management training and yoga, meditation, so all of which could contribute to the effects that he seemed to have seen in that tiny population. So again, I don't know. I can hardly believe that's the extent of the clinical trial evidence for the vegan diet, but I still don't know that yet.
Another question touches on actually a couple of others that came along.
Okay.
And that is the studies that you've referred to have largely been conducted in a North American or at least a Western style context. And so we wonder if you could share the experience of studies done in other countries. The example here is given Europe versus the USSR, which I guess dates the questioner a little bit. But maybe that's a historical question about what may have existed during that era. Certainly was a lot of vodka consumed at that time. But in general,
alcohol is the one thing correlated.
That's another question.
Moderate alcohol consumption. I'm not sure that I know enough about really all the evidence from different parts of the world. Maybe you have a sense of that better than I do.
Well, I would just share your opinion here is that we need to learn more about the success of other diets and other population groups. And since you asked me a question, I'll just briefly suggest that there are important differences among ethnic and population subgroups around the world that may have in part a genetic basis. And so that citing examples from, let's say, the Maasai may potentially reflect a different gene pool that cannot be extrapolated to us here or vice versa. So I think what we do agree on is that this is an area in general that needs more research regarding the potential for diverse approaches that may apply different populations to different degrees. And we do need to learn more about that. I think you would agree.
I do.
Right. Okay, so here's one that I get a lot, actually. So I'm going to see what you have to say about this. We are the only animal on Earth that consumes dairy products past infancy, and many people are lactose intolerant to lesser or greater degrees. Why do you believe that consuming dairy products is healthy?
You know, I don't think it's true that we're the only species. Oh, we're the only species.
I just read that. Many people are lactose intolerant.
Yeah, I mean, there are plenty of human populations that are long-lived that have diets high in dairy products.
Yeah, no, the term used was animal.
Animal
so
species.
Non-humans.
Well, I mean, I can only say, you know, humans have been around long enough to have their own dietary adaptations. So there are lots of examples, the Mongolians and the North Indians and Punjabi Indians that I mentioned, who have a long experience in long lives and experience in eating dairy products. I think that there is a lot of variation. That's one of those areas where there's different ethnic groups and lactose intolerance has been found in certain ethnic groups and not others. But I don't think the evidence shows that we should not eat dairy products if you tolerate them.
Okay. Here's one perhaps you could educate the audience a little further on this issue. There was a rise in cholesterol associated with heart disease, but it is actually associated with trans fat intake. is this true? Is trans fat intake a major determinant of
of cholesterol?
Yeah.
You know, the trans fat story is extremely complicated. The reason that we're now getting trans fats out of the food supply is based on the evidence that shows they do raise LDL cholesterol, but by a very tiny amount. It seems that we condemned trans fats maybe for the wrong reason. And it's because LDL cholesterol is a risk factor that the government recognizes that's something that they will have policy that responds to that. I think there is more concerning evidence about trans fats and how they interfere with basic cellular membrane functioning that is far more worrisome but has not been the kind of mainstream scientific research.
Okay.
So I go into this in detail in my book, so but it is a complex story.
Yeah. Indeed. So there's a question here that I think touches on the idea of establishing causality from the kind of evidence that we have in nutrition. And there's many such questions that could be asked, but here is one that I'd like you to consider. Instead of saturated fats, do you believe that processed foods are a leading cause of obesity and disease?
Well, I'd be interested to know what you think of that. I think processed foods is a highly unspecific term. You know, you can process vegetable oil, that's one thing. You can process flour, that's another thing. You can process meat, that's something else. I mean, those all have very different kinds of macronutrient contents. And so I think it's kind of a vague term. What do you think?
Yes, well, it actually touches on the issue that, in some sense, saturated fat is a nonspecific term as well.
Right.
And so how do we categorize foods that we eat in meaningful biologically relevant
right.
terms, and I think that's part of the issue is that there's specificity at the level of a food that can't easily be deconstructed
right.
in terms of its individual components, and so processing is one of those things that carries with it the stigma of losing something that's natural in the whole food itself, and so I think that's my guess is that's the intent of the question, and it. I believe touches a little bit on the vegan question,
right?
Because such diets can be consumed using wholly natural foods
right.
that avoid some of the types of processed foods that we, I think, agree are a concern, mm-hmm. such as carbohydrates.
Wait, I just want to follow up on this point that you made about different kinds of saturated fatty acids having different effects because. Dr. Krause was the chair of the Nutrition Committee at the American Heart Association for 2 terms, and you were the first to point out that different kinds of saturated fats, fatty acids, had different effects. And I remember that was part of the scientific report that you wrote, but you said it was hard to get that advice out to the public because the level of specificity that is hard to communicate.
It's complicated. So let me take this excellent opportunity to announce that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is investigative journalist Nina Teicholz, who is discussing her nearly 10 years of research that call into question previous scientific studies about nutrition. And I will attest to those 10 years because I think I was involved from year one.
You were.
You worked very hard in this project.
He's just wondering why it took me so long.
Here's a great one I just saw, so I'm going to read it to you. What is the popular myth taking hold today that will be debunked in the future? Gluten, some examples. Gluten, exercise, fiber, name your fat.
Yeah, well, let's see. It would be nice if it was chocolate cake, right? But,
no, that's
you know...
That's a fad that will never go away.
I think that... I think it the gluten... One is questionable because it is when people reduce, there is genuinely gluten insensitivity, but when people reduce gluten in their diets, they're also reducing carbohydrates. So it's very possible that gluten is kind of a marker for carbohydrates, and what we're really seeing is that people get better when they restrict carbohydrates in their diet. So I'm not sure that there's so much gluten intolerance as we think, but what do you think?
Oh, I think it is misunderstood.
as a nutritional issue. There's so much that goes into the subject of reactions to food, sort of the reverse placebo effect and all kinds of things that are very hard to nail down without objective measurements. I think what could help in this whole field, not just with gluten, but to have markers, biomarkers, that could really nail down a particular response to diet that would be either adverse or beneficial. But we're far from that. So are there, this is kind of a VN question again, but let me ask the second part of this, because this we haven't discussed. I know your answer to this, but I think we should get it out there, is how do we quell environmentalists and animal rights activists and feed the world's population on this healthy diet?
So, you know, yes, the environmental ethical questions around eating animal foods are huge. And I have to say that it took me many years to just answer the question. The scope of my book was, what is healthy? What is healthy for human beings, especially to try to help with the load of obesity, diabetes, and heart disease? And that took, you know, years and years of research. And so I think that, you know, first there's so much discordance and disagreement about what is a healthy diet. So I feel like we just need to get to have some agreement and understanding of that, and then figure out how to make those foods sustainable. And there's just, that is also a huge subject, you know, how do you raise animal food sustainably in a way that is ethical and humane.
Okay. Well, let's take a few minutes to talk about eggs. Since I started my career with the American Heart Association Nutrition Committee, as you mentioned, trying to explain to the public that cholesterol in eggs is not the cholesterol in the bloodstream, and that's a version of the issue you pointed out with regards to fats in the diet and fats in the body. And I think we could do still need to do a lot of work in educating people about cholesterol itself as an agent for good or evil. So here's a question about eggs. I've heard eggs are fine as long as they are poached, soft, or hard-boiled.
Wow. Have you heard that?
Kind of, because the next part of this question, so I apologize to the questioner, because there's a legitimate question at the second part of this. Not the first is... It's okay to say, but the second is the question. If fried or scrambled, they are oxidized, creating free radicals. So that's...
I don't know about that. I can say if they're fried or scrambled in vegetable oils, that would not be... I mean, I know that creates oxidation products. You know, the dietary cholesterol, the cholesterol you eat, does not become the cholesterol in your blood. For the great majority of people, your body will regulate the amount of cholesterol it produces in response to the cholesterol in your foods. And that's been known really since the 1970s. There have been experiments of people eating, you know, dozens of eggs a day and not seeing an effect in their own bloodstream. And that's been also been conducted in large studies. And actually, the American Heart Association, as you probably know, dropped its dietary cholesterol limit last December. The last Western nation, I believe, to do so.
Well, it took you 10 years. It took us 20. So here's one that takes you more to the historical investigative work that you've done. Looking back at the surge of heart disease in the 1950s, we now know of the two other surges of 25 years earlier, per capita cigarette consumption and per capita sugar consumption. And so the question is, why didn't these surges, and I would ask you about sugar in particular, get more attention? I think you kind of alluded to that, but maybe you can elaborate.
Why did it not get more attention?
Right.
Well, I think that, you know, there were scientists who were alerting the public, or trying to alert the public, to the dangers of sugar. There was one scientist in particular, an English scientist named John Yudkin, and Ansel Keys was aware of that competing hypothesis to his own hypothesis and did a pretty good job of slandering John Yudkin. I think the main reason is just that the entire nutrition establishment was so completely focused on dietary fat. There was really like this they had blinders on with respect to any other kind, anything else to study. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of studies looking at various kinds of saturated fatty acids and their effects on different kinds of blood cholesterol. And that was it for decades until Gary Taubes really started to propose that there might be this alternative hypothesis about what causes heart disease, obesity, and diabetes, and he proposed that that might be carbohydrates, including sugar.
So you touched on this a little bit as well in your talk, but I think this question could bring out some further discussion around the Mediterranean diet. The question is, what is your opinion on the high-fat, low-carb Mediterranean diet, and about the evidence for the Mediterranean diet itself, which doesn't necessarily require that you eat high levels of beef and whole milk products.
Right.
So what's your sense of the evolving research in that area?
On the Mediterranean diet.
Yeah.
Well, I think the Mediterranean diet was a kind of antidote. It was introduced in the early 90s, and it really was an antidote to the low-fat diet that Americans had been living through for decades. So here was a diet that proposed that you could have, finally, you could eat a lot of fat and not get sick. So, you know, an olive oil in that case. And the Mediterranean diet was particularly well-studied because it was in the Mediterranean. And there, the olive oil industry funded a fantastic series of conferences for researchers to go in Greece and Italy and Tunisia, and these were just known as some of the best ever food conferences in the history of nutrition science. And, you know, Ansel Keys himself, his study team all fell in love with the Mediterranean, and they built villas there, and they're like south of Naples, there's a little colony that they all established with their villas, and they, you know, the Mediterranean has had this allure. It has an allure for everyone. But I guess what I suggest in my book is that it might be possible that any higher-fat diet is healthier than a low-fat diet. The Mediterranean diet is healthier. It does seem to be healthier than a low-fat diet. It's possible that there are other high-fat diets and other traditions in Sweden, in Holland, in other places where they eat a lot of fat, and people might want to eat their own ancestors' diet rather than have us all be eating a Mediterranean diet.
Okay, I'm going to take this one. Well, we talked about the environmental footprint, the use of water, and I know you don't want to comment on that in detail.
I don't know, it looks like my brother-in-law's handwriting.
So here's one that I'd like you to comment on, because this is something you are currently doing, apparently we need more of it. The question is, how can we get the words out about the research and your discoveries? How can we do a better job of getting this out other than an event like this?
Well, that's such a nice invitation. I don't know. Buy my book and tell your friends.
No, that's not enough. That's your answer. Okay. Let me ask you a little bit about your book, since I knew this was going to come back to your book. The subtitle of your book is that butter, meat, and cheese belong in a healthy diet.
Right.
So I'm going to take the prerogative of asking a question about your understanding of the word belong. Because without really parsing that very carefully, it could lead to the opinion that this is really necessary for a healthy diet. That's the way it can come across. And I wonder if that's really your intent. You talked about the health benefits of those kinds of foods, but we've also talked about the ability to construct diets that have the right kinds of components and appear to be just as healthy that don't have either butter, meat, and cheese. And I would actually focus on meat, perhaps even more so, because you can follow a meatless diet you can do quite well, perhaps even better in some diseases such as diabetes. So could you just comment on what your intent is in using the term belong?
So I think there is some evidence to show that saturated fats have necessary biological functions in terms of immune health and also in the brain. But I do think the larger argument that I make about saturated fats in the book is simply that we ought not to be avoiding these foods, that a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet is healthier, and it's very hard to eat a high-fat diet, nearly impossible to eat a high-fat diet without eating animal foods. So it's not absolutely necessary, but it's very hard.
Right. Well, yeah, so, yeah, and we could talk about this for a much longer time than we have, because we're reaching the last few minutes of our conference, but I think that there is the potential in the sort of media bite, sound bite coverage of this whole topic to swing from one end of the pendulum to the other. And assume that if it's not this, it's that. That was a question raised earlier, and that there's really evidence on the other side that would suggest that we really should be increasing our intake of saturated fat per se, which could be done in ways that we don't yet know the consequences of.
Yeah, I think you get to the absolute part of the issue here, which is, okay, saturated fats have been unfairly condemned. The evidence seems to have dissolved. And so if you have false evidence against something, let it out of jail, right? But why keep it in jail? Why force it to be prove itself to a higher standard than, say, broccoli or kale? Like, why should it be forced to be the subject of a 2-year-long clinical trial high in saturated fat? It's like keeping somebody in jail and saying you need to show good behavior, even though all our evidence against you is gone. So, and I think that I do not make the argument that people should be going out and eating sticks of butter. There are people making that argument, but I don't. But I think this is really at the heart of the issue, and it's again where I draw upon the lessons of history and examples of populations who have been healthy historically, because I think nutrition science has ignored that historical record.
I think you will get a round of endorsements for that. So unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and I'm actually going to take the prerogative of asking that one as well. And that is, if you had all the resources in the world, including money, which is in short supply for this sort of thing, what would be the study or research project that you would endorse, or projects that you might endorse as helping to steer us in the right direction for future dietary recommendations?
Well, you're the researcher here. I don't know. I would like to see that long-term clinical trial be done, looking at high-fat diets with different kinds of fat, and to see what are the consequences of a diet that's higher in olive oil, a diet that's higher in saturated fats, and various maybe different levels of carbohydrates. I'm so interested in your answer to the question too, though.
Well, you'll check my next grant application. So actually, we have reached the end of our time. I could be delighted to talk to anyone about this particular topic after our meeting today. But to remind you, I'm Dr. Ronald Krause. I want to thank Nina Teicholz, a former NPR journalist and author of the new book, The Big Fat Surprise, and our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. We do want to remind everyone that Nina will be available for book signing outside this room following the program, and we would appreciate your letting her make her way to the signing table as quickly as possible. So again, I'm Dr. Ronald Krause, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.